Good morning. How's everyone doing this morning? Everyone's excited about talking about data access? I have to admit it's a fairly vague session title that I have. And I guess that gave me a lot of options and flexibility in deciding what to talk about today. So what I thought about is just kind of have a breakdown of the different approaches that you could have to write data access code, because ultimately, what do we want to do? We want to get to a SharePoint list. It's got these items inside there. I want to be able to get at the items. I want to be able to add items. But we have, you know, many different options, you know, as far as using the APIs to get to this data. And some work well on the server. Some, you know, are on the client, a little bit more complicated. So kind of going through some of the options about, do I want to use CAML? Do I want to stay away from CAML? And do I have to write server-side logic versus client-side logic is, you know, hopefully what we can get down to. Now, how many people here have been doing SharePoint development in 2007? Okay. So, how many people here have never used the SP query object? Okay, just a couple people. So what I want to do is kind of start with what's familiar to you, the SP query and SP site data query. And then talk about some of the other options. How many people have already used Link and feel that they're at a kind of a comfort level or intermediate level with Link or above? How many people are just getting started using Link? Okay, a bunch of us. And I think Link is, you know, in many ways a new kind of fancy way to access our data. It's definitely got some benefits. But I think you'll see that Link's just this kind of pretty layer on top of what we had down below. And there might be some reasons you can't use Link. There might be some reasons that you decide not to use Link. But just to kind of really kind of put in context the productivity we gain from it, but the fact that it's kind of a luxury as opposed to a necessity to use Link is another important thing that I want to get across. So let's go back here, and I have a test site that we're going to be using here during this session. And we're going to start with a brand new blank site. So I'm going to start with a brand new blank site. I have a couple different things that we're going to look at here. And first of all, I'm going to go ahead and deploy this server farm solution. So the first set of examples I'm going to have, I put into a farm solution because basically the code has to run on the server. So while you could put the code behind a web part, you could put the code behind, you know, an event handler, I put the code behind application pages. You know, so I have three application pages that are going to be doing our querying. Now, let's go back here and kind of get our data up and going. So when I go ahead and I run this solution for the first time, it actually creates four different application pages. You know, the first one is going to be create customers. So let's take a look back here. And I'm going to go back to layouts and create customers. And I'd show you the UI. But I think you'll see it's not all that impressive as far as what it does. But what I want to get at here is kind of what we're going to do. And here we're using the server-side object model. And we're going to say this.web, so remember when you're inside of an application page, you know, I inherit from layouts page, you can also say this.web and this.site. So in this case right here, we're going to go ahead and try to get the customers list to see if it exists. If it exists, we'll delete it. Then we'll go ahead and we'll create this new list. And notice that I'm just basing this on the contacts list. You know, so everything I'm going to do in this session is just going to be against the built-in contacts list type. Got first name, last name, company. It's also got the issue where there's that special column named title, and it's been changed over as far as its display name to last name. And that's another issue that we have to think about. I also have this little utility code called Wingtip Customer Factory. And without going into too much detail, we have this Wingtip Customer. And then it was one of those things like when you teach and you speak a lot, you go on the road, there's a lot of extra nights in hotels you're not really sure what to do with. So what I decided to do is kind of create this fictitious names code So I just took the 100 most popular girl names, or maybe it's 1,000, a lot of most popular boy names, put them inside there. There's a bunch of fictitious company names. So I'm able to create, you know, basically any number of random customers. And so in our case right here, we're going to create 100 customers. Also with this list, I'm using random functions, and you can basically, you know, you can have a consistent seed, or you can have an arbitrary seed, so you can make a predictable list. So every time I create this, it would create the exact same list inside because I'm passing true inside. Okay, so let's go ahead and create the customers here. And so basically, this is now going to run through and use that custom code to create random customer 1, 2, 3, and basically just push them into this list. And now we're going to have something to query. Okay, in a second, it's going to come back here. And there are my different customers that we have there. And if I go back there, you know, you should see that I've created a certain amount of customers. If I keep going for this particular demo, I think we've got it. So we have exactly 100 customers. Okay, so now let's take a look at our basically our first query that we're going to run inside there. So the first time we're going to run this query, we're going to use the sp_query object. Now, coming back and taking a look at the SP query object, well, we go ahead and we get a particular SP list item. So the SP list item, you know, is always going to be the object on which you execute the SP query queries. And we have to say, view fields, what are the types of things that you want to bring back? You know, here's the case where, you know, you have to know that the column is underlyingly named, you know, title, not last name. Okay. So I'm guessing that many of you have kind of been through this where you go through and, you know, build your field refs. And then here's a language that only a mother could love, where begins with first name, value equals B, order by title equals first name. Okay. Now that we've got that, well, I can go ahead and call get items, and that gives me back my SP list item collection. And what I need to do is somehow put the data somewhere. So in this case right here, you know, I've tried to do binding all throughout the all my demos. So where this item is not, you know, really something that is easy or practical to bind, what we've done is we've created this new generic list based on the wingtip customer class. And so when the data comes back, I'm just going to enumerate through each item and basically, you know, use the indexer syntax to basically pull out and build one of these customer objects. And now I'm just using an ASP.NET grid here. The reason I like the ASP.NET grid in some cases compared to the SharePoint grid is it supports the auto-generate columns. If you ever try that with the SharePoint grid, it basically fails. You have to explicitly bind all the columns, which sometimes is great, but for easy to digest demos, you know, the ASP.NET, you know, demo grid, you know, certainly makes for less work. Okay, now, as I start, you know, running these particular things inside here, I have this particular query object, and that is my SP query. If I come down here and we start looking at some of the things, well, there's this query throttle mode. And if I go to this particular option, this is something that's new. It might be a breaking change inside your code. So back in SharePoint 2007, we had this, you know, basically a state where we could query. And if I ran a query and the results came back as 50,000 items, well, my code ran. There was nothing that was going to cause my code to blow up. And in 2010 now, we have some throttling that's put in place. So for the average user, the throttling, which is set per web application, is 5,000 items. And so now we have this case where the code that you ran in 2007 and brought back 8,000 items is now going to break in 2010, because if you exceed the throttling threshold, well, it's going to break, unless you go ahead and you explicitly do the override. Now, let's say that I'm the you know, the fellow that administrates the, you know, the farm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over to Central Admin for a second. And inside of Central Admin, I'm going to go to my web applications. And under web applications, we can go ahead and under the web application in question, we're going to go to resource throttling. And what we can see here is that, you know, by default, it's set to 5,000. And by default, it's set so that if you are running server-side code, your kind of code running with full trust, you can say, forget about throttling, turn that off so that I can query for as many items as I would like. So what that means is, with the default settings, all you got to do is basically, you know, take the throttle options, you know, and set it to override, and then you basically, you know, made the request to basically succeed in executing the query for any number of items. Now, of course, you could be in an environment where the farm administrator says, I don't care what the developer says. Now, this is not the default option, you know, but realize that someone could set things in saying, my developers are more dangerous than my users. Why would I let them, you know, run these queries and get back any number of items? You know, so if you try to basically go into the, you know, override mode and it's set like this, it's going to fail. Since some of you might be new to this throttling, note that we have a list view of 5,000 for your typical user. There's also the list view for the administrator or anyone who's kind of marked as an auditor, which by default is set four times as high. Also note that there's this daily window. And so if we have throttling in place, you know, what's throttling really there for? You know, throttling is really there to protect the front-end web servers from having, you know, all their processing cycles soaked up by these really inefficient queries. And SharePoint's never really had a problem keeping 50,000 items in a list. What SharePoint has a big problem with is when I call the all items view, and it basically makes the call to the database, brings back all this data, and then it tries to take the data, which is in some streaming format, and to convert it into HTML. It uses the camel, and it's basically going line by line through there. And kind of over years, we've said, well, 2,000, or now we're saying 5,000 is the max. We don't want to have, you know, larger queries than that because it just takes too many processing cycles to basically build the HTML on the front-end web server. So in SharePoint 2010, our philosophy is, well, let's not make everybody suffer because a user runs a bad query. Let's just make that user suffer. And so list throttling says, basically, fail instantly, don't do any work, and just tell the user, hey, you asked for too many things. You know, so what this also gives us the ability to do when we want to deal with throttling, we can also say, well, that's just during normal business hours. You know, but at 8 p.m., you know, for, 4 hours, we're going to go ahead and turn that off. You know, it's what we call happy hour, because we basically turn throttling off for some period of time. And during that part of time, you know, your code wouldn't have to turn things off. You know, but what I'm trying to get at is that when you write code, you have to very much be thinking about whether throttling is on. And if your code is running on the server, you can turn it off. If your code is going through the client side, you can't turn it off. You know, generally, your code running on the server is kind of trusted at a web or farm level. And whenever you run code from the client, it's never trusted beyond the scope of the site collection, you know, so they don't let you do any type of throttling override in that particular area right there. Okay, so now that was our first thing that we've looked at. And what I assume is that, you know, except for the throttling, you know, none of this is new. Well, now let's go look at our second option. And our second option is going to be the SP site data query. Yeah. How many of you used the SP site data query in 2007? A handful. And how many of you didn't use it because you didn't know about it? A couple of you. How many didn't use it because you heard it was really slow? A couple of you. Well, first of all, let's cover how this thing works. So if we go back here and look at the SP site data query, I've got this SP site data query object, and we're going to put in the view fields, you know, just like for the SP query object, and then we're going to do a where clause. Now, the big difference between executing this and executing SP query is SP query always is executed on the context of a single list, And so the data that we're querying is obvious. With the SP site data query, we're going to execute these queries at the site level. And so it's not obvious which list or which lists, you know, will be, you know, joined into the result set. And so because of that, we have to be a little bit more careful about how we go ahead and, you know, ask for things. So in this case right here, when I run this, I'm going to say, oh, by the way, since we're looking at every single list inside the site, well, let's go ahead and specify the content type as contact only. And also make sure they only start with B. So if we come back over here and, you know, this looks great, let's do one other thing. Let's go down here and let's go to more create options. As I go to more create options and we go to lists and we go create a second contacts list. And so, you know, let's say that this is just some list of my buddies that I want to create inside here. And now we'll go through here and we'll add one of our American talk show idols, Bob Barker. We'll go ahead and add that inside there. And so now that we've done that, let's go back to this SP site data query. And you can see that, you know, the big benefit of the site data query is it gets items from multiple lists and automatically aggregates them together. You know, so as opposed to you having to get data from three different lists, taking three SP query objects, executing them, getting the results, and having to aggregate the results, you know, yourself, you know, this can be a real nice thing to do. You know, think about doing roll-ups. You know, I have a site collection. I have lots of child sites down below. Each one has its own customers list, but I want an aggregation. I want to basically just see, you know, all the customers put together. So by running these queries, you know, that can be a very efficient thing to do. Or at least it can be a very productive way, you know, to start writing your code. Now, some of the things that we have to keep in mind is that, well, you can put a scope in place up here. And by default, it basically runs it at a recursive level. But I can also say site, only look for contacts list in my site. I could say recursive, look for contacts list in my site and all the sites down below. Or I could say site collection, I don't care what site I'm in, go to the top level site and basically run it on the whole site collection. You know, so you have a lot of different choices. You know, what's neat about recursive is, you know, imagine we have, you know, the corporate top level site, and then we have the northern division and the southern division. And so I go to those child sites and I start running the queries just for the contacts in that site and the sites down below, so I don't get the site collection wide. You know, so there's neat things that you can do inside there. Now, this would get you in a lot of trouble if you, like, let's say I took this part and removed it. Well, if I took that and removed it, I'd likely get into big trouble because I haven't specified what list. And so it's going to find announcements lists. It's going to find content. It's going to find all these different lists. And so you have to worry about the columns that you ask for. Because what I might be doing is I might be asking for something that's not in every single list. So the way this thing works is that it goes and finds all the candidate items. And then after it finds the candidate items, it looks for what columns you've asked for. And if it finds like an announcements list item, it's going to say, hey, you've asked for first name. Hey, that's not a match. It's going to throw that item away. So while this does a lot of work for you, the one side effect of this is it's not very fast in a lot of cases. Because quite often it's laying a lot of stuff out in memory and then kind of scratching its chin and thinking, ah, let's throw this one out, throw that one out. You know, so while it's powerful, you know, what a lot of people found is when they wrote web parts and they use these kind of queries and they put the web parts on the home page, as the data got larger and larger, you know, all of a sudden it was taking, you know, 5 seconds, you know, to process every request for the home page. You know, so I'd say use it sparingly if you're going to be doing, you know, large roll-up queries. And also, you know, don't put it on the most popular pages, you know, but put it on the pages that people, you know, only need to go to at certain times. Okay, and notice that this has the, you know, the override as well. Now, what we've looked at so far, you know, these two different options to basically, you know, get at our data. And both of these options, you know, require that we write these CAML fragments. So now what we want to look at is, you know, some other options. So there was this big move to link, and it didn't happen in SharePoint first. You know, it happened over in the .NET, you know, world with all the SQL programmers. But, you know, the reason that we have link is that our data access code over the years has kind of had some, you know, notable shortcomings. And so one problem that we have is data access programming differs for each type of data. So I've got customer data. Each customer has, you know, six values, six different columns. Yet sometimes when the customer data is in SQL, well, I use one programming approach. Sometimes it's in an XML file. I use a different programming approach. Sometimes it's in a SharePoint list. There's a different programming approach. You know, so wouldn't it be great if there was just one particular API? Another huge problem is the fact that data access programming in the past has generally lacked type safety. So I'm programming ADO.NET, and I finally, you know, get to my particular data set. I look at data rows, and it's time to go to row number one, and then I open up, you know, the square bracket, and I put in the quote, and I type the name of the field and hope to heck that I got it right. But whenever you have to open up the quote and type in a column name, the compiler can't help you. Compiler can't say, hey, you got that right, you got that wrong. We're going to have to test it and find out at runtime. Also, I don't have any IntelliSense. You know, IntelliSense can't help me out there. So one of the things that Link is going to do is kind of get the strong typing and kind of make that so it's built in, and so we have higher levels of IntelliSense. And the other thing that we want is not only do I want to have the same style of programming against a SQL table as a SharePoint list as an XML document, well, let's go ahead and put things like where clauses and order by clauses into the programming language so that I don't have to worry about the difference between a where clause when I go against SharePoint data as opposed to when I go against SQL data. Now, here's my funny slide for the day. I look up there, I just love to look like the before picture. Okay, but I digress. But if you look at the top, you know, that's where we've been. Well, I create this SP query object, and is the compiler, the C-sharp compiler, ever going to help me if my CAML fragment isn't right? Absolutely not. So now what we're going to is this world where we have these data contexts, we create a particular object, and then I start writing this link syntax from query, from announcements in DC dot, and the IntelliSense drops down, allows me to pick in the particular set of data behind my data context. And then I can write my where clause just in a regular language. Okay. So obviously, we can see that the strongly typed nature of what's on the bottom and the fact that we get IntelliSense to tell me what the column names are is going to put the developers in a better space. Now, when we look at the link support, what's important to see is that link supported for kind of the mainstream programming techniques against SharePoint lists, you know, which is great, but CAML hasn't really gone away. So when we write link queries and Lambda expressions, what's going to happen is that there's this DLL that the SharePoint team created, basically loads in, reads your link query statement, and translates it to CAML and executes the CAML behind the scenes. You know, so don't think that link is replacing anything. It's just this productivity layer on top of what is already there. And there's going to be some times when you're going to say, hey, the productivity here is just, this is great. You know, it's just so much easier for me to add items to my list and for me to, you know, retrieve items and get them back. But there could be some times where it doesn't really help. So one issue that we have now is that while we have great link support, it's easier to program against lists, there's no way to turn off throttling. So that little productivity layer we put on top forgot to add a switch to say, hey, turn off throttling so if my link statement brings back 8,000 items, it doesn't fail. And that was just kind of a shortcoming. You know, it wasn't put in by design. You know, but unfortunately, they don't expose any way for you to be able to change that in the current released form. Another issue that we have with link is that we have to know the column names ahead of time. So if you have a case where here's my list, and it's got these eight different columns, and I can run a utility that builds some code, and I can start doing link programming, that's great. But what's going to happen if someone changes the column name, removes the column, adds a column, and I want to program against it? Well, we're going to have to generate, you know, regenerate this link code behind the scenes. You know, so there's this type of program, and let's say the type of program you're writing has to be able to plug into any site, has to be able to figure out what lists are there, and basically discover the columns at runtime so you can kind of build some type of interface. Link's going to give you no help there. You know, so that's one of the cases where you're still back to, you know, writing SP query and SP site data query objects. And once again, you're not going to give up any performance. You know, you're not going to give up any functionality. You know, what you're going to give up is, you know, just time and writing CAML statements as opposed to, you know, where you could just be knocking out link statements a lot quicker. You know, so basically that's going to be your main trade-off. Okay, now, if we're just starting out with link, and I don't want to take much time because this is not a link-based talk, but just to kind of talk through some of the things, link has built-in support for .NET objects. So if I want to program against, you know, one of the built-in collection classes or array classes, hey, there's great support for link inside there. But when we get to external data, like a SharePoint list, well, there has to be this provider that's put in place. Now, the providers that we have out there, there's one to talk to SQL with. Actually, there are a couple to talk to SQL with. And when they created link, what's, to me, you know, one of the things that's important to see is that they created link, a fellow named Anders Heidelberg from somewhere close by here, you know, created this thing. And I had a point there. I'm sorry. Let me get my point again. I was about to say something really intelligent, and now I feel bad that I'm not going to be able to say anything that intelligent for the rest of the day. Okay, what I was trying to get at is that, okay. I guess I just thought about Anders and the blood rushed to my head because I was so excited and I just forgot about everything there. okay, so here's the point. Okay, it's back. When they created link, it was kind of an effort. Anders Heidelberg and the .NET team were creating this, and they built in this .NET support so that every object in the .NET framework, you know, that supported INT could automatically be accessed through link. Then they had to say, well, how about data that lives over there? How are we going to get that in? And so as part of that initial project to build link, there were the SQL guys. Hey, we need you to build our reference implementation of a link provider. So they started building the, you know, link to SQL provider. They've kind of changed their strategy over the years. But I think, you know, what we've seen is that when they built this thing for SQL, is SQL something that you can really optimize? Absolutely. And as they were building link, they were like, okay, we got this DLL. It's a SQL provider. Hey, SQL does this a little differently. Can we bend link a little bit as we're designing it just to really match up with SQL? And I think what we found is, you know, by the time link was done and we had this link to SQL story, it was really, really good. And so a couple of years later, you know, here's this, you know, red-haired stepchild called the SharePoint team, and they need to build, you know, their link to SharePoint provider. You know, that's 2 or 3 years after the big party. They're not working hand-in-hand with the link team. And so, you know, for people who want to match up, hey, I know how to do link programming in SQL, so SharePoint's got to be just as good. You know, absolutely not. We have this first-generation provider. And these people on the SharePoint team were building something to take your link statements, switch them into CAML, execute them, and have data things behind the scenes. And so one of the things I see is I see people reading some of these link books talking about going to SQL. Well, I read link query 1, and then I have, you know, link query 2 run on link query 1, and link query 3 run on link query 2, and then I go ahead and do a for each loop. And I read that The provider's smart enough to take all these things and issue them in a round trip, a single round trip to the server, and not to do it until the four. And you're going to say, oh, that's great. I get that in SharePoint too? Not so much. You know, so just realize that the state of the two providers are very, very different. And just, it's not even the people that wrote the providers, you know, but just think about, here you are programming against, you know, SharePoint on the web server as opposed to programming against SQL from across the network. How many more optimization opportunities were there for the SQL team? There were tons more. So I think what you're going to find is that we're just now at the beginning state of doing, you know, link to SharePoint programming. And as I start doing joins, three-way joins aren't really going to work. A lot of times you'll run a two-way join and you'll try to do some aggregation and you'll get something back saying inefficient query. An inefficient query means you can't do this in SharePoint these days. And so you switch it into two different queries and you bring back your data locally and then you start like doing your joins locally. So I think, you know, a year to 2 years from now, as an industry, we'll really have kind of been through, you know, the limitations of the link provider to SharePoint, and we'll know a lot more about what works, what doesn't work, what to do because this doesn't work. But because we're so new to it, I don't think we've got any feedback yet. You know, but just to give you an expectation of how mature is our provider compared to, you know, people who have been using the link to SQL providers, you know, not very. Okay, now when it's time to go ahead and do things inside of SharePoint, what we do is we use this tool. We use this tool called SPMetal. SPMetal lets you point to a site. You point to a particular SharePoint site. You can do it from across the network. And you call this tool SPMetal, and then you pass it, in addition to the URL to the site, two things. Because you're going to say, hey, create a piece of source code for me. And so here's the name of the source code file I want you to create, and here are the namespaces. And so inside of our particular project, we have this SPMetal generated class right here. We open this thing up, and as I look through this, you know, one thing that you're going to need once you put the SP generated class inside there is that you have to add in the Microsoft.SharePoint.link assembly, because there's all these Microsoft.SharePoint.link list attributes. You know, the other thing that I would recommend is the first time you start programming against link and you create this SP metal generated source file and you stick it into your project, you can look through this, but to get started, it's going to be a lot easier for you to go over to class view. Over inside of class view, let's go ahead and look down inside there and customer site and customer's contact and customer site data context. You know, so these are the type of things, you know, that are going to be easier for you to get through. Now, if I look at this piece of code here, and we kind of start looking at, you know, how we do link style programming. What we're going to see is that link style programming gets to be pretty easy because I've got this state customer site data context. I go ahead, I create that, I pass in the URL to my current site, my current SP web object. And now we can start running these from customer in dc.customers. And obviously, if I'm coming down here and I'm saying customer dot first name dot starts with B, and we go ahead and we compare that to, you know, you writing this particular text with no IntelliSense, you know, that's where we get our big savings. You know, so it's really in the productivity side, you know, that we have so much help inside here. The other nice thing about link is, you know, I could come through here and, you know, I could certainly come back and do something like this and say customer, dc.customer. Let's go ahead and run this guy right here. So I'm going to come back here. We're going to go ahead, do another deploy. But I kind of want to show you the advantage of using a projection. So go back here, and when this is all done, and we go ahead and we run this guy right here. Notice that this comes back, but they generate these classes for you. So let's go back here. And note that if I look, you know, one more time at this thing they created, they create this customer contact. And if I look at customer contact, that is a class that inherits from contact, which is a class from inherits from item. So when you use SPMetal, what SPMetal is going to do is it's going to look and find the lists inside your site. And it creates a class for each content type for every possible item that you might be bringing back. But just like they use an inheritance hierarchy when they create content types, they use the same inheritance hierarchy as they build these. So they'll always build the item class from the item content type. And from that, they create the contacts item type. And because my list, customers, was created from contacts, well, then they create this, you know, this entity class based on the contact type, and it's called customers item. And so that's what we have right here. If I say, show me customers item, shows me last name, but it puts a bunch of stuff inside there I might not want. So a really neat trick, you know, when we're doing programming right here is rather than just, you know, project back items of the same type we've just looked through, let's go ahead and switch it to this right here. So this is the notion of an anonymous type. It's as if I went off and created a class that had these particular properties, and then I called new on that particular class. So when you call new, and you just open up the curly brace, you're creating a new object, and you're just making up the list of fields as you go right here. So one of the things that you'll really start liking about Link, if you start using it, let's go back here, is the ability for you just to use a projection and an anonymous type to basically create whatever mappings you want on the fly. So in this case, all I'm doing is I'm taking the names of the columns and putting it inside here. But certainly you could create your own, you know, let's go back here, full name equals, and now we could say, you know, customer dot first name plus customer dot last name. And now that we've got this in place right here, you know, before I run this, let's go and kind of take a look at the you know, data set that we've built here on the fly. First name, last name, and so back here, I've built this projection, and we just basically, you know, added in some kind of calculated column on the fly. Let's go ahead and rebuild and redeploy this code one more time. And so now that we've done that, we'll come back here and we'll execute this, you know, one more time. You know, we're going to be able to see that, you know, we've added in that other particular column right there. And, you know, now that I've just basically added whatever columns I want, you know, being able to bind to the ASP.NET grid and put it on auto-generate columns, you know, gets to be a pretty, you know, simple thing to do. Okay, so let's go back to our slides. And, you know, as you go through there, you know, dealing with the data context, you know, querying items, you know, inside of a list gets to be pretty easy. How about adding things? Adding things gets to be really easy, you know, compared to, you know, you going through the SP item, you know, choosing add to the items collection, checking the, you know, indexer approach of, you know, title equals this, first name equals that, choosing update. Well, now I'm going to create an instance of this customer contact class. I'm going to initialize that, and then I go to my data context and say insert on submit and submit changes. And basically that's what sends things back. And there's all kinds of batching techniques. You know, I could create an array, you know, based of 10 or 100 and submit those all at one time, you know, if I feel it kind of improves my performance. Okay, now, what we've looked at so far, you know, are things that, you know, work well on the server. Now, SP Query, SP Site Data Query, and all the link to SharePoint stuff have to run on the web front-end server. You can't have a client running across the network run this link to SharePoint stuff. You know, so what are we going to do? So we're going to look at two other approaches. Well, one is let's use the client object model. Now, inside of this code right here, let's go back. I've got a second project right here. And the reason I split these up into two projects is everything we've seen so far has to be deployed as a farm solution. Because, you know, basically code's going to run on the server. well, you know, I don't want to say you have to run this stuff, you know, from, well, it does have to run on the server. But, you know, could you push it out in a sandbox solution? Yeah, you could. You know, you could push it out. You could put some of this code behind a web part, run it inside of a sandbox solution. But you're going to find that some things, you know, don't work as well inside there. Okay. Let's just talk about sandbox solutions in general. We're going to be able to do some data access. You know, we're going to be able to get to the site collection. But when you're writing code inside of a sandbox solution, other than the data that lives in the current site collection that you're dealing with, what other data can you get from around the network? What do you think? Can you get to any other data from around the network? Oh, come on. This is the audience participation part of my lecture. I made you guys laugh. Okay. So the answer is no, you can't really get anywhere. I think one of the things that people are going to, you know, within the next year, stand back and say, oh, my God, the sandbox is so restrictive. You can't call and make an outgoing HTTP GET request to a web server in your own internet environment. So you are totally locked down. You know, so how do we get out of the sandbox? Because you're going to create a sandbox component, and at some point, you're going to want some data that lives somewhere else. So, okay, there's this approach where you can create these things called trusted proxies. And so the sandbox code doesn't run with full trust, but now I can create another class that calls to my web service, and there's this approach for creating the trusted proxy where we create it, we put certain attributes in place. We then have to install it as a farm solution and register it, and then we can call into it. But that might be a lot of overkill. But here's the great part about sandbox solutions. Their protection protects the web server. They don't give a darn about what happens to the client. So if you have code to reformat the client's hard drive, Sandbox Solutions doesn't care. Okay, so what I'm trying to get at is quite often we're going to use the client, and whether it's going to be Silverlight or it's going to be JavaScript, that is the code that's going to be making the call to some web service to get back data. Now I got the data in the client, and I've got to basically push it into the site collection. So that's going to get to be a very common pattern. And when that happens, you're not going to get the data back on the server. The data is going to be on the client. So how are we going to be able to get that data and do something with it? Okay. So in this first example right here, what we have is we have this sandbox solution. Let's go ahead and deploy this sandbox solution. And as I deploy this sandbox solution, let's go ahead and see what it looks like. Come back here, let's do a refresh, and now I have server-side code, server-side code, server-side code. How about some client-side code? Okay, so now we got some client-side code that's going back and doing some work on our behalf. Now, as far as, you know, how we make this work, well, first of all, note that there is this thing which we call a module inside of the SharePoint developer tools. And when you add a module, you put things inside. So I'm going to put these page templates inside. In this case right here, notice that when the feature activates, it's going to take this site page template and create a site page instance at this particular location. And so then the next thing we want to do is we want to get a Silverlight application running on there. And so inside of this page, we're going to put an object tag. Now, Silverlight, to me, is actually a very simple technology. And, you know, even though, you know, Microsoft has kept saying, hey, we've made Silverlight better and better and better in SharePoint, you know, I'll say from day one, SharePoint hasn't done a lot to help us or stop us integrating Silverlight, you know, into SharePoint sites. Because it's really all about getting the object tag on the page and having the zap file somewhere accessible. And if I wanted to, I'd go back to SharePoint 2001. I could probably, you know, get that working with Silverlight. You know, over the years, they've made a couple things a little bit better. We now have a Silverlight web part in SharePoint 2010 to create the object tag, because God forbid we'd have to create the object tag ourselves. One of the things I wanted to show you here is that all you really have to do is create the object tag and make sure the zap file that it points to is accessible. So certainly I could show you that this page, you know, to host this, you know, is not a very complicated page. It's really nothing but an object tag. Then we have a Silverlight project. And so if I came down here and said add new project, and we added a new Silverlight project, I could add Silverlight app number 3 inside here. When you use Silverlight, you know, you have your choices between Silverlight 3 and Silverlight 4. Silverlight 3 comes out of the box with SharePoint 2010. About 35 minutes after the released Visual Studio 2010, Silverlight 4 came out. And so what we can do is we can download the Silverlight 4 tools. For the purpose of this lecture, it doesn't really matter which one you use. You know, Silverlight 4 has got some advantages over 3 in different areas. You know, but for what we're talking about in this talk, it really doesn't matter, you know, which one of these that you use. So now we have this Silverlight app, and we start building out the Silverlight app. And we've got this UI inside here, and as I start building out this UI, I'm going to look at the code behind here. But at the end of the day, every single Silverlight project has its output, which is a zap file. If I say build, yeah, it'll build a DLL, but it will also, you know, build this zip archive with a zap extension, XAP, and build the DLL inside there. And so really getting the zap file, you know, somewhere into the SharePoint farm, whether I stick it in the content database or whether I stick it on the web server itself, doesn't really matter, as long as I can reference it properly. And so here's the thing that the SharePoint developer tools team did that just made things so easy. If I go down to my module, so this is a module that's in a SharePoint project, and the SharePoint project is in the same solution as one or more Silverlight projects. We go inside here, and we go down to this module, and there's something called output references. If I go ahead and look at the output references, there's Silverlight Demo 1 and 2. And so just to kind of show you, let's go up here and say project, new project, and we'll go ahead and take Silverlight app. And so if I was going to create, you know, Silverlight app 3, and do you want to have it hosted? I'm going to say no. What version? Only because I've installed the SharePoint, the Silverlight 4 tools. You know, do I have options for both? We'll go ahead, we'll choose that inside here. And now that I have Silverlight App 3, let's go ahead and kind of show you how easy this works out inside here. What have I done wrong here? That doesn't look good. Oh, first of all, let's turn the sound off. So you guys don't know I have any kind of problems up here. Okay. What? I'm not sure what I've done there. Okay, I might have to install now. Okay. Hopefully that wasn't a bad choice. Looks like it was a bad choice. Okay, well, let's do that one more time. Okay, so what I wanted to do more quickly than that was to show you it's pretty easy to add these particular files in. Let's go ahead and add them one more time. TEDS O Data Demo. Well, basically, once you add the thing in, and then you go down and you take the particular module and you add the output reference, what's going to happen is it automatically updates your elements.xml file to basically push out the Xamp file. So now every time you hit deploy, it takes your Silverlight app, it recompiles the Xamp file, it sticks the Xamp file inside your feature directory, and automatically creates an instance of it inside of the site. And what's neat about this, if you push this out in a farm level solution, and you have 100 different sites that all activate this, they're all using a ghosted version of the Xamp file. So when you update your solution package, you basically replace the old Xamp file with a new Xamp file, and all the clients automatically get updated. You know, if you do it as a sandbox solution, updating is harder because, the WSP file with the Xamp file has to be pushed up and updated, on a per site collection basis. Okay. Well, now you've kind of seen, using the Xamp files and getting things running just in the context of a Silverlight app, let's kind of dig into what the Silverlight app's going to do. Well, the first thing that we're going to do in this Silverlight app, which is the client object model, is we're going to reference microsoft.sharepoint.client.silverlight. So remember, there's a client object model, which is new to SharePoint 2010, which is based on this WCF entry point called client.svc. And one of the nice things about the client object model is even though it requires WCF programming underneath, we, the mainstream programmers, don't come in contact with WCF. So what we do is we create these friendly objects, and we call methods, and behind the scenes, it makes the WCF calls, back over to the front-end web server for us. And there's three different layers. There's one for regular .NET. There's one for Silverlight. So remember, Silverlight is a compact version of the .NET framework, so we need our own special SharePoint client object model, DLL, inside there. And then there's also some JavaScript wrappers so that your JavaScript code can call into the object model. So we're doing it the Silverlight way here. And now we can go ahead and look through some code. So what we're going to do here is we're going to use part of the SharePoint client object model, something called a client context. Also note that they have, the SP web and the SP site. They just take the SP off the names. So this web object is a site, and there's also a list, and there's this thing called the camel query. Now, when this page initializes, one thing that I need to do is I have to get this thing which is called the synchronization context. Synchronization context, when we start programming Silverlight, is going to be important because when it's time for me to do something on the client, I'm going to send a request across the network. I don't want to do it on the primary user interface thread because that would basically freeze the browser. And so what I need to do is I need to be executing calls asynchronously on a secondary thread as not to block the main thread. But what's going to happen is when we call across the network on that secondary thread, when it comes back, it gives me my notification on a secondary thread. That secondary thread cannot touch any user interface controls. But the secondary thread has to somehow tell the primary thread, hey, we're done here. Can you go ahead and update the controls inside here? So for that reason, quite often we work in terms, of this special threading object, you know, which is called the synchronization context, defined inside the system.threading namespace. Okay, so we go ahead and we set that. Now, here are some other just general Silverlight code to do things, you know, such as, you know, find the URL to your target site. Now, once you found the URL to your target site, because, you know, your Silverlight app's running on a page, you could say, hey, what site am I in? Now we're going to call new on a client context. And now another thing that's kind of strange about the object model, when you start using it, is you can't just get to a site object and say .title.id, but you have to make requests to bring the data across the network. So what we generally see is if you want to get something like the site title, that you're going to say client context, you know, .web to get to the site, and then you're going to say client context.load, you're going to load the site, and then you're going to say client context. And you're going to call some kind of execute method, probably the asynchronous one, that's actually going to do your work. So it goes across the network. It then sees, hey, there's a load request. I better grab this data and bring it back. So it just comes to a, you know, a different style of programming that we might not be used to when we start using the client object model. Another thing that I would suggest just to kind of get your sea legs is if you just create a regular Windows app, a console app, or a Windows Form app, or WPF app, those things run on the desktop, and I use then the full-blown .NET SharePoint client object model, and you can execute things, you know, without going through the asynchronous mechanism. They have a synchronous execute method there, but you can use those to kind of get up to speed on having to call load and not getting that to one of those objects until they're initialized. And then as you move over to Silverlight, then you kind of add in the complexity of having to, you know, deal with asynchronous execution for everything that you want to send back. Okay, but in this case right here, we say get by title customers, and then I'm going to go ahead and load that in, and now here I am building the camel query and basically putting the camel inside here. So now you're thinking, gosh, this is just like server-side SP query stuff. Yeah, it is. You know, so if we have a server-side object model with SP query and, you know, SP site data query, and you got to use camel, well, when you go to the client-side object model, that's the same issue. It's not strongly typed when we go and access data. And, you know, we have to write some of the same camel fragments inside here. Okay, so now we can go ahead, we can add those inside here, and you can see that after I create this camel query, well, now it's customer list.getItems. Go ahead and load that. And now I make the round trip across the network. Now is when I say execute query async. And really all I can do is point to a method to execute when we succeed and point to a method to execute if we fail. And so this thing gets called right here. And what happens is it makes the trip across the network. And when it comes back, if it succeeded, it executes this first method. If it failed, it executes this method. But also keep in mind that this method executes not on the primary UI thread. It executes on a secondary thread. And you will get in trouble if you try to reach to a data grid or some other control and touch it inside there. And so one common technique that we can use is to use our synchronization context and use the post method. This basically says raise an event on the primary UI thread. So we point to this method. Second argument is for passing any arbitrary state that you want in a system.object variable. We don't really care about that here. But now this method will execute on the primary UI thread. And so what I can do inside here is, okay, well, let's go grab these. And now I'm going to take this customer list item collection. I'm going to move through here and create a whole bunch of, you know, these local wingtip customer objects just so I have a bindable collection. You know, basically that's what kind of gives me, you know, my ability to go through here. You know, but now that we've done that, you know, let's look at some of these, you know, other methods right here. You know, get A customers, get B customers. And the only thing that's different about these is I switched this out. I'll leave it to you, you know, to, you know, take these four methods and come up with a more practical, modular way to do that. You know, but now here I am over on the client, and you can kind of see that, you know, executing these camel queries, you know, even though you're kind of doing the work, you know, putting together the camel to figure out what columns and, you know, doing the, you know, the work without as much help as we get from Link, you know, that can be, you know, somewhat helpful inside there. Okay, now, still have one more case. And that final case that we have has to deal with something that we do from the client side, a second option. And it's going to be using REST-based access through this web service called listdata.svc. And so what you're going to see is that this is something else that will work in the Silverlight application. However, we're not going to require the DLLs. In that first example, I had to add references to two different DLLs, Microsoft.SharePoint.Silverlight.Client, or Microsoft.SharePoint.Client.Silverlight, and then Microsoft.SharePoint.Client.Silverlight.Runtime. In this case right here, we're just going to create a web service request, and it's not going to require, you know, as much work. Arguably, this is also going to be more performant because it's just a simple REST-based GET request. Now, let's go back and see this thing at first. So let's go back to my site. And if I go back to IIS, I go back inside of IIS here. And inside of IIS, I'm going to go look at my sites inside here. And here's one that's a SharePoint web app. Let's get into content view. And let's go to this old thing, _VTI_bin. Hey, that's been SharePoint for a while. Let's go ahead and open that thing up. And notice that this is where a bunch of ASMX files are. As I look down through here, hey, here's client.svc. That's also the entry point that when I use the client object model, I've got these little proxy objects that call to this guy right here. There's nothing that Microsoft has done to make us be able to program directly against client.svc. You know, so you always go through one, you know, one of the DLLs or through the .js files, you know, to get at this right here. But the thing that we're interested here, let's go down here. Oh, remember this guy? List.asmx. How many people in the room have had the pleasure of interacting with this asmx file? Anybody? Did you miss it? Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to switch over to this guy right here, listdata.svc. So from any site inside your farm, from across the network, you can type in the site and then _VTI_bin listdata.svc, and what do we get? Now, there's one little gotcha here. SharePoint, when you install it, forgets to put on a special component, which is called WCF Data Services. So when you install that, you know, make sure that you kind of take care of the shortcomings of the prerequisite installer by going and installing the right version of WCF Data Services. To make things more confusing, when it was in beta, they called it ADO.NET Data Services. They switched the name to WCF Data Services something like December 18th, but on December 15th, they put it in ADO.NET Services, .NET 3.5 Service Pack 1 release up there, and then they took it down, and then some people at Microsoft said, no, you have to put it back, and you have to call it what you called it at first. So for some reason, it's still called ADO.NET Data Services, and I think just with .NET 3.5, that's what they call it. When you finally get to 4.0, then they start calling it WCF Data Services. So don't let the name hang you up, because once you install this, they put some code behind the scenes that makes this thing work. Now, if I come back up here and I take a look at this and I see data services, hey, that's great. What if I come down here and I say /customers? And all of a sudden, let's come back up here and let's go ahead and view the source inside here. And so what you'll see is that this is Microsoft's old data story. So there's a feed of lots of different things inside. You know, if you come up here and you say, you know, customers, you know, sub one, I can't remember if it's the parentheses or the square brackets. And then sometimes you return this back and under page, view source. You know, so realize that sometimes the Explorer, you know, doesn't show you these when really it did indeed pass you that back. Under the tools menu, you can go and kind of turn off, you know, the intelligence or the lack of intelligence in IE to stop doing strange things and just to show the XML to you directly. but what we have here is, you know, basically lots of different ways to get our data. You know, so this is REST-based. So, you know, what is REST-based access? That means for any result set you could want, there's a different URL to express it. So there is an URL that you could put in place right here to basically say, hey, I want to filter this where first name, you know, starts with B. And so they're able to put that, you know, into the particular URL by adding things into the query string. And so to access this API, all you really need to do is make HTTP GET requests and know how to come up with the correct URL. Now, to make things a little bit easier, you know, what they've done is let's go ahead and, you know, take this right here. Let's now go to Visual Studio. Let's go ahead and say new project. And let's go ahead and create a console application. I create this console application, and I could do this behind a Silverlight app as well, but it's going to be a little bit easier if I kind of just show you how simply this thing works. So now I'm going to add a service reference, and we're going to go ahead, we're going to say go. And so what happens is when you call to this, listdata.svc is a WCF data services implementation that SharePoint has provided. And so one of the big things that, you know, the data services give us, you know, just on top of the WCF layer by itself, is the ability to discover a set of lists or tables inside. And then Visual Studio adds in support to creating proxy classes inside your client as well. So in this case right here, let's go ahead and say something like, you know, wingtip site. And we'll go ahead and choose OK. And now that we've put that in place right here, let's come down here and we'll say using, and we'll say using console app 1, wingtip site. Okay, so now that we've got that inside here, there is this wingtip data context equals new wingtip data context, and now we're going to say new URI, and then we're just going to basically put in, you know, that particular URI here. Now, if you do this in a Silverlight app, you don't have to worry about security credentials, you know, because your security credentials are already established because of the browser, and so your Silverlight app just piggybacks off that. But because I'm writing a console application from across the network, well, I'm going to do something such as DC credentials equals, and because I'm running on the same machine, I can kind of do what I would do inside of a LAN environment, which would be system.net.credentialcache, and I can just use my default credentials. If I was calling from across the network and we were going through a firewall, I could set up basic authentication. I could set up client-side certificates. You know, so there's, you know, lots of different ways that we could set up the credentials. Well, now that we've got that inside here, let's say DC dot, and how about add to customers? Gosh, that couldn't be any easier. Kind of new, new customer item, and now I come through there, and you know, business phone equals, you know, that, and, you know, first name equals that. So, you know, so creating a new customer, you know, with this technique, you know, is going to be pretty easy. And then DC dot, and then we have a save changes. You know, so you can see that this is a lot like Link in the fact that, well, I didn't really use SP Metal, but I kind of pointed Visual Studio to that listdata.svc file, create a bunch of proxy classes, and I just basically program against the proxy classes, and it does what I need to have done. And realize that the proxy classes that they create, they just put source code, you know, into your project that knows how to do all the HTTP, you know, get requests across the network for you, and all you have to do is, you know, call save changes. You'll find that the code that they give you is not quite light link, kind of does the same things, but they kind of made some arbitrary choices, you know, about, you know, what gets included and what doesn't get included. What I want to do here is let's go ahead and say something like var query equals, and now we'll say DC dot, and there's that customers list. So if I say, you know, from customer in customers, you know, where customer dot first name, you know, starts with B, and then we'll say, you know, select customer. And now that we've done that, we'll have a for each loop for each item in query. And then we'll do a console write line item dot last name. And then we'll have item dot first name. And I'll go ahead and we'll run this query from across the network. And hopefully we'll come back in just a second. But you kind of get the idea about this particular service. Hopefully that's just taking a second there. So now, you know, I've been able to go and execute that, you know, and get the data back. And so, you know, now if I come back here, you know, to the original solution right here, you know, so now we have, you know, the Silverlight 2 project right here. And if we kind of look at the code here, it's going to be kind of the same thing where I went to this Silverlight app and we said, you know, add service reference. We added in the wingtip site. And so now we're going to have, you know, the same approach, you know, of being able to create the wingtip data context, you know, being able to bring things back. Of course, now you have to kind of deal with the begin execute and end execute. So I wanted to show the console app because I didn't want you to have to kind of you know, wrestle with the whole asynchronous execution the first time you saw it. But that's, you know, something you're going to have to do when you kind of build it into the Silverlight app. But now you have something that the Silverlight app is going to be able to reach inside there and just use HTTP GET requests from inside. Okay, let's go back to the slides. So you kind of saw we create the client-side proxy class. And remember, that's optional. You know, if you really get into WCF data services and link data.svc, you might just learn how to say, okay, let's go to listdata.svc/customers/1, and then you learn how to put the filtering query string, the order by query string. You might not need to go through that API at all. Then you'd just be basically issuing strict HTTP GET requests. But the API and, you know, the proxy classes, you know, just make things easier, and they give you this, you know, the sense of the you know, the remote queries to make things easier to program with. And so as far as, you know, adding data with this and being able to enumerate through data, I think what you'll see is that, you know, the WCF data services has some of the same benefits as Link into the fact that now I have, you know, type checking. When I look at my columns, it's generally data source dot, and there's a list of my columns in IntelliSense, and I pick one. And then when I go ahead and I add new items, I create a new instance of this type that was created for me, and things like first name, last name, company are all hard-coded inside there. So, you know, as we kind of end here and I kind of look at, you know, this list of five things, well, which of these five are you going to use? And I think each one, you know, might stand out on top of the four others in certain scenarios. You know, so I want the most efficient way to query a huge list. How are you going to beat SP Query? Well, you might argue, God, it's going to take me all day to figure out this camel stuff, but it's not going to hurt your performance once you start running the thing. You know, so just the productivity involved in SP Query and SP Site Data Query and camel query, you know, are probably the reasons why we might kind of prefer the some of these new things. you can also see that, you know, there's some times where your code can't run on the server. You know, you got to run in a sandbox solution. You got to get a ton of data from across the network. What your Silverlight app is going to call across and get. Now the data's in the client. How are you going to push it inside there? And so those two choices of, you know, the client object model with the camel query and WCF data services, you know, are then going to be, you know, your two options. And once again, camel query is going to be very efficient, but it's not strongly typed, and you have to create the camel yourself. If you've created the camel yourself for a couple years now in 2007, you don't think it's a big deal, you might be fine with the camel query. You know, other times you might be doing something where just having the strongly typed add method that you saw there, you know, might be a big advantage. okay, so there are the different options that you have. You know, hopefully that gives you a kind of a good breakdown of your different choices inside. I think we have time, so I should get off the stage, let the other speaker prepare. But I'd be happy to take, you know, as many questions as you have offline afterwards. You know, so thank you for coming to the session. Hopefully you got some good information out of it.